There is this this really fascinating phenomenon that happens when you observe someone who is just an absolute master of their
Oh
craft.
yeah, like watching a true professional at work.
Exactly. Let's imagine like a brilliant cardiothoracic surgeon or maybe a master architect who has been designing these massive skyscrapers for 2 decades.
Right.
When you watch them work, there is this expectation of just total absolute fluency. I mean, the surgeon steps into the operating room, looks at the monitors, and their hands just seem to know exactly what to do.
Yeah, there's no hesitation at all.
Right. Or the architect looks at a complex topographical map and just instantly visualizes the foundation. The expertise just flows out of them. It's completely effortless.
Well, that's because the expertise is deeply ingrained in their neural pathways, you know? At that level of mastery, they no longer have to think about the micro movements.
Right, the basics are just automatic.
Exactly. They aren't thinking about the fundamental rules of their discipline anymore. They are operating on high-level pattern recognition, muscle memory, and instinct. It genuinely is a beautiful thing to witness.
It really is. But, and here is where it gets incredibly frustrating, and this is kind of the core of what we are unpacking today.
Okay, wait on me.
You can take that exact same master, someone who can command a chaotic boardroom or close a $50 million merger or, diagnose a systemic supply chain failure in like 5 minutes.
Yeah, total powerhouse.
Right. And you ask them to write a book about exactly what they do every single day. You sit this brilliant, high Google Doc, and suddenly all of that fluency just completely
Oh,
evaporates.
it's a total freeze.
Yes, that little black cursor just blinks at them and they are paralyzed.
It really is a total paralysis. The master suddenly feels like an absolute novice.
It's like taking our master cardiothoracic surgeon and asking them to perform a delicate quadruple bypass, but instead of handing them a scalpel, you hand them a vintage typewriter and tell them to get to work.
That is a great analogy. It's just the completely wrong tool for the environment.
Exactly. And if you are listening to this right now and you fit the profile of the learner, meaning you have years of hard-won expertise, you have brilliant ideas, and you know deep down that you need a published book to scale your business.
But you just keep staring at that blank page.
Right. Feeling stuck, overwhelmed, and frankly, maybe a little embarrassed that you can't seem to get it done. Well, this deep dive is custom tailored for you.
Because the friction you're experiencing is not a character flaw. I think we need to state that right up front.
Yes, please say that again for the people in the back.
It is not a lack of discipline, even though that is probably what you were telling yourself every morning. It's not a lack of knowledge. And it certainly isn't that you don't have anything profoundly valuable to share.
So what is it then?
The problem is entirely structural.
Okay, so our mission today is to completely dismantle this pervasive myth that writing a respected book requires you to sit in isolation at a keyboard for like 500 grueling hours bleeding onto the page.
Which sounds awful, by the way.
It does. So we are going to teach you a radically different approach. We are reviewing a fascinating concept today laid out in a book called Talk Your Book Into Existence by Michael G. Annalis.
It's a game changer, really.
Totally. We're going to examine the main flow and path of what he calls the dictate method. And the foundational aha moment here is that your inability to write isn't a failure of willpower.
Right, it's a format mismatch.
Yes. Because experts are trained to talk. They teach, they explain, they consult, they persuade out loud in real time.
They are simply not trained to sit in silence and write long-form prose.
Which makes so much sense when you say it out loud.
And we really need to validate that conceptually before we move forward. I mean, the traditional publishing path, the idea of outlining, drafting, revising, and agonizing over sentence
That
structure.
classic English major approach.
Exactly. It was designed exclusively for professional writers. It was an industry built by and for people whose primary dedicated craft is stringing words together on a page.
Not for the CEO trying to run a company.
Right. It was never designed for busy service professionals, agency founders, financial advisors, or specialized consultants. If you are struggling with a traditional method, you are not failing the method.
The method is failing you.
Precisely. Because it demands you adopt an entirely new profession just to share the expertise of your current one.
I think that framing alone is going to take a massive weight off the shoulders of anyone listening. But before we get into the actual mechanics of this dictate method, we kind of have to talk about the stakes.
The why.
Yeah, exactly. Why does this even matter? If writing a book the traditional way is so painful, why not just abandon the idea entirely and stick to what you know?
Well, Giannoulis refers to this dilemma as the authority gap.
The authority gap. Okay. What is the actual tangible cost to a professional's business if they just accept this paralysis and remain unpublished?
The cost is staggering, honestly. And it is usually entirely invisible to the person paying it. It manifests as missed opportunities across what the book categorizes as the five revenue mechanisms of a published book.
Five mechanisms. Let's explore these because I feel like this fundamentally shifts the paradigm. A book is not just a nice vanity project, right?
Not at all. It's not just a bucket list item to show your mom. It is a hard-working business instrument.
A business instrument. Okay, let's break down those five mechanisms. I want to know exactly what I am leaving on the table if I let that blinking cursor defeat me.
All right, the first mechanism is what the book calls the premium business card.
Ooh, I like that.
Right. Think about the standard interaction at a high-level networking event. You hand someone a piece of cardstock.
And they immediately lose it in their pocket.
Exactly. All you are doing is trading contact information. The psychological dynamic is horizontal. You know, you are peers. But when you hand a prospect a physical copy of your published book.
Oh, that's different.
The dynamic instantly shifts to vertical. You are the author. They are the reader. You are pre-selling them before they even read a single word.
Because there's weight to it. Literally and figuratively.
Right. By the time they flip through the table of contents and see your frameworks and then eventually get on a discovery call with you, they aren't asking if you know what you are doing.
They already know you do.
Exactly. They are asking how your proven knowledge can be applied to their specific urgent problem.
Wow. It completely eliminates the need to justify your own existence on a sales call. You aren't auditioning anymore.
You're consulting from minute one. So the second mechanism is the speaking circuit ticket.
Okay, tell me about that.
Well, event organizers and conference planners are terrified of putting the wrong person on stage. I mean, their reputation is entirely dependent on the quality of their speakers.
That makes sense. A bad speaker ruins the whole event.
Right. So they desperately need a shortcut to vet credibility. A published book is the ultimate shortcut. It signals to an organizer that you have structured your thoughts comprehensively enough to fill 200 pages.
Which gives them the confidence that you can easily fill a 45-minute keynote slot without rambling or, you know, embarrassing them.
Precisely. Without a book, you are constantly pitching yourself, often begging for unpaid breakout sessions. But with a book, you become a known quantity and you start getting invited to the main stage.
And usually with a speaking fee attached, right?
Exactly. Now, what is the third mechanism? I know from my own reading that this one can fundamentally change the trajectory of a consulting firm.
Oh, you mean the fee multiplier?
Yes, the fee multiplier. And you are right. It is perhaps the most transformative mechanism on the list. When you publish a recognized, well-structured book in your specific field, you don't just arbitrarily decide to raise your prices by 10%. The market itself repositions you. Your transition from being, you know, just the financial planner or a marketing consultant who is forced to compete on hourly rates with everyone else in your zip code.
To being the authority.
Exactly. You occupy a category of one because clients perceive you as the definitive expert who literally wrote the book on their problem. Price resistance just plummets.
Because they're not price shopping anymore. They want the person who wrote the book.
Exactly. The ceiling on your previous fees suddenly becomes your new floor.
Man, I can see how that alone pays for the effort of creating the book 100 times over. So let's look at the fourth mechanism. The book calls this the inbound lead engine.
Yes. Think of a book as your most tireless employee. It sits on Amazon or in an airport bookstore 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
It never sleeps.
It never takes a vacation. It doesn't require a monthly ad spend or an ongoing retainer. A CEO sitting in an airport lounge is searching for a solution to a chronic management problem. They stumble upon your book. They spend a flight reading your perspective.
And by the time they land, they are actively reaching out to your firm.
Exactly. It is the ultimate inbound engine because the lead arrives already indoctrinated into your specific way of thinking.
That is so powerful. And finally, the fifth mechanism, the course or program foundation.
Right. If you have any ambition to scale your one-on-one services into a group coaching program, an online course, or a certification program, the book serves as your canonical text.
Because it forces you to organize your thoughts.
Yes. It forces you to crystallize your intellectual property into a linear, teachable format. Once the book exists, building the curriculum for a high-ticket mastermind is incredibly straightforward because the architecture is already locked in place.
So we have the premium business card, the speaking circuit ticket, the fee multiplier, the inbound lead engine, and the course foundation.
That's the list.
But as Janulis points out, all five of these powerful mechanisms remain securely locked away behind the authority gap if you can't figure out how to extract the knowledge from your brain and get it onto a page.
Right, which is the big hurdle.
Which naturally leads us to look at how highly successful people usually try to solve this problem. The source details the four failed paths, and I think we really need to deeply understand why these standard approaches crash and burn.
Because it highlights exactly why the dictate method is so necessary.
Exactly. So what's the first failed path?
The first failed path is the most common advice you will hear. Just write it yourself.
Ah, the sheer willpower approach.
Right. The classic strategy is to block out an hour every morning at 5 a.m., commit to writing 1,000 words a day, and power through via sheer discipline.
But let's go back to our master surgeon analogy, or let's say a highly sought after corporate tax attorney. Telling that attorney to just block out an hour a day to write prose is a recipe for disaster.
It is completely unnatural.
It's like telling a marathon runner they just need to practice running in ski boots. It is the absolute wrong gear for the terrain they're trying to navigate.
It is, and the hidden economics of this path are genuinely brutal. I mean, a traditionally written, high-quality business book requires somewhere between 300 and 500 hours of dedicated time.
500 hours? Why?
And that is not just typing. That is outlining, researching, writing a terrible first draft, agonizing over revisions, restructuring entire chapters.
It is a massive undertaking.
Now, if you are a listener with a thriving practice, let's look at the opportunity cost.
Yeah.
If your effective billable rate is $400 an hour, 500 hours of writing equates to $200,000 in lost opportunity cost.
Just to write the book.
Right. And if you are a high-level consultant billing $1,500 an hour, you are risking up to $750,000 in lost revenue just to sit in frustration staring at a screen.
That is sickening to even think about.
And the reality for busy experts is that there is never a magical quarter where 500 free hours suddenly appear on your calendar. So the book simply never gets finished.
Which is exactly why successful people with resources immediately pivot to path two. Hire a ghostwriter.
Yes.
Path two.
The logic is sound, right?
Yeah.
You say to yourself, okay, I have capital, but I have absolutely no free time. I will just pay a professional writer to do this for me.
Makes sense on paper.
And the book notes that engaging a truly competent, serious ghostwriter for a business book usually requires an investment of anywhere from $30,000 to $80,000.
That is the going rate for quality. But while a good ghostwriter will certainly deliver a structurally sound, grammatically correct manuscript, the core failure of this path lies in what we call the voice mismatch.
Voice mismatch. Tell me more about that.
Well, taking raw interview audio and translating it into readable prose is a profoundly creative act. The ghostwriter has to make thousands of micro decisions about word choice, sentence length, and tone.
And they bring their own baggage to
it. Exactly. Because they are the one physically typing the words, the ghostwriter's natural voice will inherently, often subconsciously, assert itself over the expert's voice. I think the most powerful illustration of this is actually found in the foreword of the book, which was written by Rick Molero.
Oh, yes. Rick Molero is the founder of his capital group. The guy has facilitated over $500 million in real estate transactions. His story was incredibly revealing.
It perfectly encapsulates this specific trap, doesn't it?
It really does.
Yeah.
Molero talks about how he originally tried to write his book himself, taking that first path, and he failed within 6 weeks because his massive real estate business simply swallowed all of his available time.
Naturally.
So he pivoted to the second path. He hired a top-tier ghostwriter paying well over $50,000. And to be fair, he admits that for his first book, a pure business and strategy book, it worked well enough.
It got the job done.
It opened doors and established authority. But he explicitly noted how exhausting it was to constantly fight with the ghostwriter during the editing phase just to keep his own authentic voice intact.
Right, because the ghostwriter is trying to make it sound professional, which usually just means generic and sterilized.
Yeah, precisely. And the real breaking point came when Molero wanted to write a second book. This time, he didn't want a strategy manual. He wanted a legacy book.
Something much more personal.
Yeah, a book filled with his personal history, his deepest philosophies, stories for his children, and the intimate lessons of his life. He realized very quickly that paying a ghostwriter $50,000 to translate his most personal, vulnerable memories into the sanitized voice of a stranger just wasn't going to work.
It wouldn't sound like him at all.
Right. It wasn't economically viable to do it again, and more importantly, the end result simply wouldn't sound like their father. It would sound like a polished writer impersonating their father.
That is such a profound realization. So if writing it yourself steals hundreds of hours you don't have, and hiring a premium ghostwriter costs a small fortune and often strips away your authentic voice, people inevitably look to technology.
Which brings us to path three.
Path three, which is incredibly prevalent right now. Prompt-based AI generation. You just open up ChatGPT or Claude, type in a sophisticated prompt like, write a 10-chapter book about modern leadership principles for tech startups, hit enter, and you have a manuscript by Friday afternoon.
And we cannot deny the speed. It takes minutes, perhaps hours, if you are meticulously prompting chapter by chapter.
It's fast, sure.
But the core failure of this path is fatal for anyone trying to build true authority.
Yeah.
Prompting AI to generate a book produces prose that is structurally plausible, grammatically flawless, but entirely generic and soulless.
It's just a remix.
Exactly. The AI is simply performing a complex statistical remix of its training data, which is the entirety of the internet. It lacks any specific lived experience.
And there's a huge legal issue here too, right?
A massive one. Crucially, and we're going to dive much deeper into the legal ramifications of this shortly, because the AI is generating the actual ideas and substance based on minimal prompt, you cannot legally copyright the resulting text.
Yeah, that is an absolute non-starter. I mean, if I am building my entire consulting empire around a flagship book, the idea that a competitor could legally copy and paste my entire manuscript because it has no copyright protection is terrifying.
It's a fatal flaw.
Which leads us to the final and perhaps most frustrating attempt to solve this. Path four, the hybrid coach plus AI.
This path is a bit more insidious because it feels like a premium solution. This is where an expert pays a human writing coach or a boutique agency anywhere from $5,000 to $15,000.
Okay, so you're getting some human help.
Right. The coach provides structural guidance and accountability, but they still rely on that exact same broken prompt-based AI methodology to actually generate the text. You get on a call with the coach, map out an outline, and then the coach uses AI to write the chapters.
It's essentially putting a very expensive human-shaped Band-Aid on a broken system.
That's exactly what it is.
You are bolting human accountability onto a fundamentally flawed generation engine. It doesn't fix the generic nature of the content. It just means you have someone aggressively holding you accountable to finishing a terrible, uncopyrightable project.
Exactly. You are paying a premium to guarantee the completion of a compromised asset.
So let me pause and synthesize this because it feels a bit bleak for our listener right now.
Does sound a bit doom and gloom.
Yeah. If all four of these established paths are fundamentally broken for a busy, successful expert because they either cost too much time, cost too much money, dilute your authentic voice, or legally strip you of your intellectual property, what is left?
Is it time to give up?
Right. Is the only option to just surrender to the authority gap?
Yeah.
Are busy professionals permanently locked out of those five revenue mechanisms unless they decide to take a six-month sabbatical to become a full-time writer?
That is the exact tension that the dictate method is designed to resolve. The answer is an emphatic no.
Oh, thank goodness.
But getting there requires a massive paradigm shift in how we understand and deploy artificial intelligence. We have to completely transition our mindset away from the flawed concept of AI generation and embrace the breakthrough methodology of AI extraction.
Okay, AI extraction. This is the hinge that the entire deep dive swings on. I want to spend significant time here because the book makes a fascinating historical and technological point.
It really does.
It pinpoints a very specific window around early to mid-2024 where large language models cross a critical capability threshold. It wasn't just a generic sense that AI got a little bit smarter. There were four highly specific technological leaps that made the dictate method possible.
Right.
Can you walk us through those four leaps?
I would be happy to, because understanding the technology really demystifies the process.
No.
Prior to 2024, if you asked an AI to write more than a few pages, it would lose the plot.
It would just start making things up or repeating itself.
Exactly. It was a novelty, not a reliable tool. But then, four things happened in rapid succession. The first leap was long-form coherence.
Long-form coherence.
Okay. AI models develop the ability to maintain a consistent narrative thread, tone, and logical progression across a 50,000-word manuscript without hallucinating or losing track of the overarching thesis.
So it stopped forgetting what it was talking about halfway through the document.
Precisely. The second leap was voice fidelity. The models became sophisticated enough to analyze a large sample of a specific human's speech patterns, recognize the underlying linguistic architecture, and accurately calibrate its output to match that exact cadence, rather than defaulting to its standard robotic corporate tone.
Wow. That is massive for solving that ghostwriter voice mismatch problem we talked about earlier.
Huge.
What was the third leap?
The third was structured tool use. This means the AI could be programmed to audit its own work against a strict set of external criteria in real time.
Oh, interesting.
It wasn't just generating text. It could evaluate its text against a rubric, recognize if it missed a crucial framework, and actively rewrite the section to include it before finalizing the draft.
So it basically became its own editor.
Exactly. And the fourth, and perhaps most critical leap for writing a book, was long context reasoning.
Long context reasoning.
The memory windows of these models expanded astronomically. The AI could now hold your specific voice profile, your entire raw interview transcript, the structural outline, and the entire manuscript in progress in its active working memory simultaneously.
Wait, let me make sure I understand the gravity of that. That means when the AI is drafting, say, chapter 9, it actively remembers a specific client anecdote you told it for chapter 2?
Yes.
And it can ensure it doesn't accidentally contradict that story or repeat the same lesson. It has a holistic view of the entire project.
Yes. It acts with the comprehensive awareness of a dedicated, world-class editor who has just read the entire manuscript.
That is mind-blowing.
It is. But, and this is key, while those four technological leaps are impressive, they are completely useless if applied incorrectly. And this brings us to the most vital distinction in the entire source material, the difference between generation and extraction.
Let's really dig into this, because I think when most people hear AI and book in the same sentence, they immediately assume the AI is doing the heavy lifting of thinking.
Which is the trap.
Right. They assume it's generation. But the book argues that extraction is the complete opposite process, even though it uses the same underlying technology.
It is a fundamental inversion of the relationship between the human and the machine. Generation, as we discussed with Path 3, relies on the AI to act as the primary creator.
Right.
The human provides a tiny input, like a two-sentence prompt, and the AI goes into its vast, generalized training data, which consists of millions of internet documents, blogs, and Wikipedia articles, and it synthesizes a generic output.
So the thoughts, the structure, and the prose belong to the machine.
Exactly. The content essentially belongs to nobody.
Right. It's basically a dressed-up Wikipedia article wearing a hardcover dust jacket. It might be factually accurate, but it has no soul.
Exactly. Extraction, however, completely flips the script. In an extraction model, the process starts entirely with you, the human expert. The AI does not consult its training data to generate the ideas. Instead, the AI acts as an incredibly high-powered, infinitely patient listener and structural organizer.
So you do all the talking?
Yes. You, the human, spend hours speaking.
Yeah.
You provide your deeply personal origin stories, your proprietary frameworks, your specific messy client examples, your 20 years of pattern recognition, and your uniquely contrarian opinions about your industry.
So the raw material is 100% human.
100%. The AI is then utilized solely to build a voice profile based on how you speak, to organize the massive volume of your spoken words into a logical hierarchy, and to shape that raw material into polished prose.
The structural engineering.
Right. The intellectual property, the actual meat of the book, comes entirely from the human. The AI is merely providing the structural engineering and the prose labor.
Okay, I have to jump in here and play devil's advocate for the listener because this is the giant neon elephant in the room.
Let's hear.
I read the news. I've seen the headlines. I have heard repeatedly that the U.S. Copyright Office has stated unequivocally that you absolutely cannot copyright AI-generated work.
This is a very common concern.
So if I am a listener and I am about to invest 20 hours of my precious time to this extraction method, I am terrified. Am I going to pour my heart and soul into these interviews, extract all my best frameworks, only to find out that my biggest competitor can legally download my book, slap their name on it, and sell it because I have no legal ownership?
Right.
How can you assure me this is safe?
That is the most common and, frankly, the most responsible pushback anyone can have. It raises a crucial question, and it is the exact reason why GAnalyst spends so much time meticulously defining the legal distinction between generation and extraction.
Okay.
He breaks down what is known as the human authorship spectrum based on recent, highly specific guidance from the U.S. Copyright Office.
I want to understand the spectrum because right now, to a layman, AI is just AI.
And to the law, the nuance is absolutely everything. The core legal principle governing copyright in the age of AI hinges on two questions. First, does the human exercise sufficient, meaningful creative control over the final product?
Okay.
And second, is the human the actual source of the traditional elements of authorship, meaning the intellectual substance, the specific narrative, and the unique expression of ideas?
Okay, let's apply that. If I use the generation method and I type in a ChatGPT, write a book about effective leadership strategies for a remote workforce, what happens legally?
In that scenario, the AI is performing the lion's share of the traditional authorship.
Mm-hmm.
The human just issued a generic request.
I basically just gave it a title.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The human's creative contribution is minimal and unpredictable. The Copyright Office views the AI, in this case, like a slot machine. You pull the lever, you get a randomized result. Therefore, that output is generally unprotected by copyright. Or the protection is so narrow it is effectively useless.
That makes perfect sense. I didn't write it. I just ordered it. But how does extraction change the legal math? Do I have to send the Copyright Office my raw audio files to prove I actually said it?
You don't necessarily have to send audio files unless challenged. But the underlying reality of the process is what provides the protection. In the dictate extraction method, you spend 10, 15, or 20 hours on recorded interviews providing the exact granular substance of the book.
All the heavy intellectual lifting.
Yes. You dictate your specific leadership philosophy. You recount a highly specific story about a remote employee who failed in 2019 and what you learned from it. You detail your proprietary 5-step management framework. The intellectual property, the original thought, originates entirely with you.
I see. The AI didn't invent the 5-step framework. I did. The AI didn't invent the story about the employee. I lived it.
Precisely. When the AI is used merely to clean up the transcript, correct the grammar, organize the structure, and format your spoken words into readable paragraphs, the human's creative contribution remains substantial and dominant.
That's a huge distinction.
The book makes a brilliant legal analogy here. It argues that using AI in an extractive capacity is legally comparable to a traditional human ghostwriter relationship.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. For decades, experts have dictated their ideas to human ghostwriters who then physically type the prose. The Copyright Office has always recognized the human expert as the legal author in those arrangements because they provided the intellectual core.
So it's the exact same precedent.
Exactly. In the dictate method, the AI is simply serving as an immensely efficient digital ghostwriter. The human remains the undeniable author. The AI system is merely an assistive tool.
Wow. Okay, that distinction is incredibly clarifying. It's
Why?
Like it's the difference between asking AI to invent a house versus handing AI a highly detailed blueprint, delivering all the custom lumber and fixtures, and just asking it to swing the hammer.
You own the house.
You own the house. I love that. So we have established the legal safety of extraction. But beyond the legalities, there's a powerful reader experience element that the book touches on.
Oh, the radar.
Yes. It talks about how modern readers have developed this unconscious, almost biological radar for generated content.
They absolutely have. Even if a reader has never used an AI tool in their life and knows nothing about the technology, they can immediately sense when a book is generated.
How? What are they sensing?
They're sensing a profound lack of humanity. Generated content feels entirely too smooth.
Too perfect.
Right. The opinions are too balanced, too carefully hedged, too neutral. It constantly uses phrases like, on the other hand, or it is important to consider all perspectives. It lacks the necessary friction and the rough edges of real, lived human experience.
That is so true. Real experts aren't neutral. They have opinions.
Exactly. A true master of their craft has biases. They have deep-seated frustrations about how their industry operates. They have weird, idiosyncratic analogies that make perfect sense to them. They have battle scars.
And AI generation just scrubs all that out.
Violently scrubs it away in an attempt to be universally acceptable. But, as Genulus points out, those rough edges are exactly where trust is built with a reader. Extraction preserves the rough edges. It captures your frustration, your bias, and your specific worldview.
Which is such a perfect transition into the next massive concept we need to explore. If this entire extraction method relies on capturing the essence of the human, how do we actually ensure the finished book sounds like the listener?
$1 million question.
Right. How do we deliberately capture those rough edges so the reader feels like they are sitting across the table from you having a coffee? This brings us to the fascinating concept of voice DNA.
And the book makes a bold claim right up front. Voice matters significantly more than content.
I want to push back on that a little bit. If I am buying a business book to solve a million-dollar supply chain problem, surely the step-by-step content is more important than how witty the author sounds, right?
It seems counterintuitive, but think about it deeply. The actual raw information in almost every business book, self-help guide, or leadership manual is fundamentally commoditized at this point.
Commoditized?
Yeah. If you want a basic framework for supply chain management or time management or real estate investing, you can find the raw data, the academic papers, and the basic steps for free on Google in 30 seconds. You don't need a book for the raw data.
Okay, that is a fair point. The ingredients are out there.
Exactly. What the reader is actually purchasing is the perspective. They are buying the specific delivery, the curated sequence, and the unique worldview of the author.
They want to know how you view the data.
Right. They want to hear your specific tone of voice guiding them through the chaos. If your book sounds like a sterile textbook, they will just go read Wikipedia. The voice is the vehicle that delivers the value.
So how do we systematically quantify a voice? Because traditionally, when editors or writing coaches talk about voice, they use incredibly vague, unhelpful terms. They say things like, we need to capture your vibe, or let's make sure the tone is punchy.
You can't program a system with a vibe.
Exactly. But the book breaks voice down into 6 highly specific, measurable components. It calls it voice DNA. Let's dissect these 6 components because this is where the extraction method really shows its power.
Let's do it. The first component of your voice DNA is your sentence architecture.
Sentence architecture.
This is the literal structural rhythm of how you construct your thoughts. Are you someone who uses short, aggressive, punchy lines, like a boxer throwing quick jabs? Or do you speak in long, flowing, highly complex academic paragraphs that build slowly over time?
It's the cadence.
Yes. And it also includes your specific start words. When you begin a new thought, do you naturally start sentences with conjunctions like and so or but, or do you begin with more formal structures?
I start with so constantly.
Right. If your natural spoken architecture is short, punchy, and starts with so, but the AI or ghostwriter structures your book with long, flowing academic sentences, the voice is instantly broken. Anyone who knows you will read page 1 and say, this isn't him.
That makes profound sense. You have to capture the physical rhythm. What is the second component?
The second component is your vocabulary fingerprint. These are your highly personal word choices. It is specifically not about your industry jargon. Every accountant knows the same tax jargon.
So what is it?
Your vocabulary fingerprint is about the adjectives, verbs, and descriptive nouns you default to in daily life.
Give me an example of how that breaks down.
Let's say you are describing a very strong, reliable business strategy. Do you naturally describe it as bulletproof, or do you call it ironclad? Or perhaps you prefer the word robust?
I would probably say bulletproof. I don't think I've ever used the word robust in a casual conversation in my life.
Exactly. So if the word robust suddenly shows up 3 times in the first chapter of your book, your colleagues, your clients, and your family will instantly experience cognitive dissonance.
Because they know I'd never say that.
Right. They will intuitively know you didn't write it, even if they can't point to exactly why. The extraction system must be trained to map and exclusively use your specific vocabulary fingerprint.
I love that. It's the microtells. Okay, component 3 is rhetorical patterns. This seems a bit broader.
It is. This is fundamentally about how you teach and persuade. When you need to introduce a complex new concept to a client, what is your default mechanism? Do you always lead with a personal story to set the emotional stage? Or do you bypass the emotion and lead with hard, shocking statistical data to grab their attention?
I usually try to find an analogy to explain it.
Which is perfect, because analogies are a huge part of your rhetorical pattern.
Yeah.
What are your specific analogy domains? Are you a consultant who constantly relies on sports metaphors, talking about fumbling the ball, calling an audible, or skating to where the puck is going? Or do you rely on cooking analogies or architectural metaphors? If a consultant who strictly uses football metaphors in real life suddenly publishes a book filled with analogies about sailing and adjusting the rigging, the reader's bullshit detector goes off immediately.
Right. The client reads it and thinks, wait, Jim doesn't know the first thing about sailing. He gets seasick on a ferry. Why is he writing about navigating stormy seas? It completely shatters the illusion of authenticity.
Absolutely.
Okay, component four is transition habits. The book calls this the invisible connective tissue of your speech.
It's the small, almost unconscious phrases you use to bridge one thought to the next. Some people transition by saying, "Now here's the thing you have to understand." Others will say, "But look at this," or "Let me give you a tangible example."
And what does AI usually do here?
The danger here is that generic AI models default heavily to formal academic transitions. They love to use words like furthermore, additionally, moreover, over. It should be noted that.
If I ever say the word furthermore in real life, I want someone to check my pulse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you never say furthermore in a real meeting, it has absolutely no business being in your manuscript. A proper extraction system strips out the AI's default transitions and replaces them with your authentic connective tissue.
That is so precise. Component five is incredibly interesting. The book calls it the emotional register.
This is where the humanity really shines through. What topics light you up? Mm. What specific practices in your industry genuinely frustrate or anger you?
The passion points.
Right. Every master has a topic where if you bring it up at a dinner party, they lean forward, their tempo increases, and they get deeply passionate.
Mm.
Conversely, they have an emotional baseline for things they find boring.
That makes a lot of sense.
Janelis argues that your emotional register also includes the distance between what you were willing to share and what you refused to share. A book needs to stay authentically inside that specific emotional range to feel true.
And finally, the sixth component is signature phrases.
These are the obvious catchphrases. The idioms you use so frequently that your staff or your long-term clients could practically quote them back to you. Things like, at the end of the day, or let me be completely straight with you, or here is the reality of the situation.
The greatest hits.
Yes. These are the immediate flashing neon identifiers of your voice DNA.
So knowing all six of these components, the book provides this brilliant, ruthless way to test if an author's voice has actually been captured on the page. You introduced me to this, and it is phenomenal. It's called the shortcut test.
Oh, it's so good.
I want every listener to pay close attention to this.
It is the ultimate litmus test for authenticity. If you have a draft of a book, it doesn't matter if you wrote it yourself, if a $50,000 ghostwriter wrote it, or if you had an AI generate it, take three random pages of that draft and read them out loud in your normal speaking voice.
Okay, read them out loud.
Then immediately open up your sent folder and read three of your natural day-to-day professional emails out loud. If the text from the book and the text from your email sound like they're written by two completely different human beings, your book is dead on arrival.
It is such a devastatingly simple test. I imagine thousands of traditionally published business books would fail that test miserably.
An alarming majority of them do. They sound like author voice, not the actual person. To prevent this from happening to you, the book provides a practical 7-step voice DNA fingerprinting exercise.
And you can do this without AI, right?
Totally. You don't even need AI to do this. You can do this manually to deeply understand your own communication style before you ever begin the dictation process.
Let's walk the listener through those 7 steps right now. If someone wanted to do this exercise this weekend, how would they execute it?
Step one is to gather raw material. You need a baseline. Pull up three of your most substantive recent emails and, ideally, find a recording of yourself talking naturally. A recorded Zoom presentation, a podcast interview you did, or a sales call.
Okay, step one is the baseline.
Step two, map your sentence architecture. Look at the transcript of your recording and count the words in 10 consecutive sentences. Are you averaging 8 words a sentence or 25?
Step three is identifying that vocabulary fingerprint we discussed. You literally make a list. Write down 5 descriptive words you use constantly in your business and 5 words you would never, ever use.
Step four is finding your rhetorical pattern. Listen to your Zoom recording and tally how you persuade. Do you default to telling a story, citing a statistic, or drawing an analogy?
That's super practical.
Step five is logging your transitions. Scrub the audio, specifically listening for the bridge phrases you use when moving between PowerPoint slides or changing topics.
Step six is mapping the emotional range. Think back over the last month and identify one specific moment you got genuinely fired up about a client problem and one time you deliberately held back your true feelings to remain diplomatic.
And step seven is perhaps the most revealing because it relies on external validation. You simply test 3 close friends or longtime colleagues and ask them a single question. What is a phrase or saying that I use all the time?
Oh, they'll know instantly.
You will be shocked by how quickly and accurately they can identify your signature phrases, often things you didn't even realize you said.
I love that. Oh, you always say, let's circle the wagons. You might hate that you say it, but it's part of your DNA. The overarching takeaway from this entire section on voice DNA is that traditional generation methods and even highly paid human ghostwriters inevitably fail here because the person holding the pen or writing the prompt subconsciously overwrites your DNA with their own.
Exactly. They just can't help it.
But a sophisticated AI extraction system can be explicitly programmed with these exact six components, ensuring that the resulting prose is an amplified, polished version of you.
That is the true technological leap. We aren't replacing the author. We are finally capable of cloning the author's precise communicative essence.
Okay, so we have secured the voice. We know exactly how the book is going to sound. But a great voice is useless if you don't have anything coherent to say. If you just turn on a microphone and ramble in your authentic voice for 10 hours, you don't get a book. You get a therapy session.
Very true.
We have to determine what the book will say and what shape it will ultimately take. This brings us to structuring the knowledge.
Exactly. Structure is what separates a collection of thoughts from a transformational book.
Mm-hmm.
To solve the structure problem, the book introduces the Seven Pillars Discovery Framework.
The seven pillars.
These are the seven foundational elements that must be clearly defined to give your book its spine before a single word of the actual chapters is drafted.
Let's deeply explore these seven pillars. To make this tangible for the listener, let's invent a hypothetical expert. Let's say our listener is Sarah, and she has spent the last 15 years running a highly successful boutique cybersecurity firm consulting for mid-sized healthcare companies. How does Sarah answer the seven pillars?
That's a great way to contextualize it. The first pillar is the personal path. This is the critical question of authority. Why should the reader trust Sarah? What is her origin story?
So for Sarah, maybe her path isn't just that she went to school for computer science. Maybe it's that 15 years ago, she watched a regional hospital's entire patient database get held for ransom, and she spent 72 sleepless hours negotiating with hackers.
Perfect. That crucible moment is her path.
That immediately builds credibility. The second pillar is the foundational frustration. I love this one. What is the common accepted wisdom in your industry that is fundamentally wrong and drives you absolutely crazy?
This pillar is vital because it gives the book its point of view. It creates the necessary friction. For Sarah, her foundational frustration might be the industry's obsession with buying expensive security software while completely ignoring the human element.
Right. Her frustration is that $1 million firewall is useless if a nurse writes their password on a post-it note attached to a monitor.
Yes. That frustration becomes the central thesis of the book. Pillar three is the transformation target. What is the specific measurable change the reader will experience by the end of the book?
So for Sarah, the transformation is moving a healthcare CEO from a state of constant anxiety and vulnerability to a state of robust, culture-driven security resilience.
Which leads us to pillar four, and this is arguably the most important one, the signature system. Every true expert has a signature system, even if they have never formally given it a name.
What exactly is it?
It is the specific sequence, the proprietary methodology, and the unique experience they bring to solving a problem.
And this is exactly where the deepest imposter syndrome kicks in for highly qualified experts. I hear this all the time. An expert like Sarah will look at pillar four and say, I don't have a signature system. Everything I know about cybersecurity is already out there on the internet. I'm not inventing a new field of mathematics.
Someone else has already written about firewalls.
Exactly. Someone else has already written about password protocols. Why would anyone read my book?
It is the most common mental block, and the source material addresses it with a truly brilliant analogy. Giannis compares it to cooking authentic Italian food.
Oh, I'm hungry already.
Think about it. Millions of people around the world know the basic concept of cooking Italian food. Millions of people have access to exactly the same raw ingredients: tomatoes, garlic, olive oil, basil, and pasta. The ingredients are commoditized.
Just like the raw data in an industry.
Exactly. But despite everyone having the same ingredients, only your Italian grandmother cooks her sauce her specific way.
Ah, that's so true.
She uses her highly specific sequence. She has a proprietary ratio of garlic to oil. She has a deeply ingrained, almost instinctual feel for exactly when the sauce is simmered long enough. The ingredients, the base information overlap with everyone else on the planet.
Yeah.
But the perspective, the sequence, and the execution are entirely uniquely hers. That is what a signature system is.
That is such an empowering way to view your own expertise. Sarah isn't inventing the concept of a firewall. She isn't inventing the tomato. She is packaging her 15 years of specific sequences and hard-won perspectives on how to implement that firewall in a hospital setting. She is giving the reader her grandmother's recipe.
Precisely. You don't have to invent a new universe to write a valuable book. You just have to map your specific path through the existing one.
Let's finish the pillars.
Pillar 5 is the precise prospect. Exactly who is this book written for? Sarah needs to know if she is writing a technical manual for other IT professionals or a high-level strategy book for hospital CEOs. The tone changes entirely based on the prospect.
Pillar 6 is competitive contrast. How does Sarah's book differentiate itself from the three other cybersecurity books sitting on the same shelf? This ties back to her foundational frustration. She contrasts her human-centric approach against the software-heavy approaches of her competitors.
And finally, Pillar 7 is the author's ambition. What specific business job does this book need to accomplish for the author? This ties back to the 5 revenue mechanisms.
Does Sarah want the book to generate high-ticket consulting leads? Or does she want it to serve as a curriculum for a certification program?
Right. The ambition dictates the final call to action in the manuscript.
Okay, so once Sarah or our listener answers those 7 pillars, a massive psychological shift occurs. You are no longer staring at a terrifyingly blank page. You have a comprehensive blueprint. But as the book points out, a single blueprint can be adapted to build several very different types of houses.
Well, that's right.
So the dictate method takes those 7 pillars and uses them to determine which of the 6 specific book types you should write.
This is a crucial structural decision. Matching your specific pillar material to the correct book architecture prevents the manuscript from structurally collapsing halfway through. Let's detail these 6 types.
Okay, number 1.
The first is the framework book. This is highly structured, usually organized around an acronym or a sequential step-by-step process. Think of books like Traction by Gina Wickman.
Number 2 is the authority builder. This type of book isn't necessarily a sequential how-to. It is organized around a massive paradigm-shifting idea or a deeply held worldview. It is meant to plant a flag in the ground and say, this is how the industry should operate.
The third is the how-to guide. This is exactly what it sounds like, a highly practical, tactical, sequential manual designed to solve a very specific, granular problem. The fourth is the transformation memoir.
Oh, I've read a lot of those.
Right. This structure teaches industry lessons primarily through the lens of the author's dramatic personal journey and overcoming a massive failure.
The fifth is the industry disruption. This is essentially a professional polemic. It is an aggressive, well-reasoned attack on the status quo of an industry, demanding change. And the sixth is the definitive reference. This is a massive, comprehensive encyclopedia covering every single facet of a very narrow, specific niche.
So how do you choose? You look at your answers to the 7 pillars. For example, if your pillars reveal that you have an incredibly dramatic, unique, personal path, maybe you lost $10 million and had to rebuild from scratch, but you don't necessarily have a rigid, step-by-step system, you should write a transformation memoir.
Because if you try to force that story into a dry framework book, it will just fail.
It will be a total mess.
Yeah.
And conversely, if you are like our hypothetical cybersecurity expert, Sarah, and your strength is a deeply reasoned foundational frustration with how hospitals operate, you shouldn't try to write a memoir. You should write an authority builder or an industry disruption.
Exactly. Picking the right book type based on your pillars dictates the entire structure of the outline. Okay, let's take a breath and recap exactly where we are on this journey because we have built an incredible foundation here.
We really have.
We understand the critical difference between generic AI generation and authentic AI extraction. We have mapped the voice DNA so the prose will sound exactly like the listener. We have established the 7 pillars so we know the core substance of what needs to be said. And we have selected the book type to give the project its structural architecture.
We have the blueprint, the materials, and the voice.
Now we finally arrive at the actual execution. How do we turn on the microphone and actually talk the book into existence?
This brings us to the operational engine of the dictate method, the 3-layer question system. We've established that the human needs to talk, not type.
Right.
But as we noted earlier, you cannot just turn on a voice memo app on your phone while driving, ramble for 12 hours about your industry, hand the transcript to an AI, and expect a coherent book. The extraction must be deeply guided. It requires a highly structured extraction engine.
Right, because unstructured talking is just a brain dump. It's an unnavigable mess. So how does this 3-layer system organize the chaos?
The system relies on 3 distinct layers of interviewing. Layer 1 is the discovery questions. This happens before any drafting of the actual chapters begins.
What happens in Layer 1?
In Layer 1, you spend an hour or two being interviewed specifically on those seven pillars we just unpacked. The interviewer prompts you to speak your origin story out loud, to vent about your foundational frustration, and to articulate your signature system. This session locks in the overarching spine and thesis of the book.
It sets the boundaries. Then we move into the actual chapter-by-chapter work, which is Layer 2, content extraction. And this layer is driven by an incredible tool called the scorecard. I think this concept alone is worth the price of admission for anyone trying to write a book.
The scorecard is revolutionary because it turns a rambling conversation into a precise diagnostic process.
How so?
When you are doubly passionate about a topic, it is incredibly easy to go off on a 30-minute tangent and completely forget to actually explain the core concept. The scorecard acts as a dashboard for the extraction process. It tracks highly specific mathematical targets for every single chapter.
Give me an example of what is actually on this scorecard.
For a standard authority builder book, the master scorecard might dictate that each individual chapter requires a minimum of 8 to 12 distinct client stories or anecdotes, one primary actionable framework, 3 to 5 contrarian viewpoints that challenge industry norms, and at least 2 practical tools or exercises for the reader.
So it's literally a checklist.
Yes. And the beauty of this is how it informs the interview process. Let's say you just finished a 90-minute interview session to extract the raw material for Chapter 4. The extraction system analyzes the transcript against the scorecard.
Okay.
It reveals that you provided 4 amazing contrarian points and 2 great tools, but you only provided 1 story, and you completely failed to articulate a framework.
The chapter is unbalanced. It's all theory and no narrative.
Exactly. Because the system tracks this, the interviewer, whether human or AI, knows exactly what to do in the very next session. They don't just blindly move on to Chapter 5.
What do they do?
They open the next session by saying, "Hey, Sarah, Chapter 4 is looking great on theory, but we are missing narrative weight. I need you to walk me through a specific step-by-step story of a time you implemented this theory in a hospital setting."
It completely eliminates the guesswork. You never reach the end of a 6-week interview process only to realize, to your horror, that you forgot to include any actionable advice in the middle third of the book.
It guarantees the structural integrity of every chapter before you ever begin refining the text. That is so smart.
But as great as the scorecard is, Layer 3 is where the true, undeniable magic of this method happens. Layer 3 is dynamic follow-up.
Oh, this is the best part.
And as someone who conducts interviews for a living, I can tell you that Layer 1 and Layer 2 can be rigidly scripted in advance. Layer 3 cannot be scripted. It is the unscripted, highly reactive magic that occurs in real-time conversation.
It is the absolute secret sauce of the dictate method. Why is it so powerful from an interviewer's perspective?
Because the most profound, valuable moments in an interview are almost never the rehearsed answers to the prepared questions. When you ask an expert a direct question about their framework, they give you the polished, PR-friendly answer they've given 100 times on stage.
Right, the canned answer.
But during that polished answer, they will inevitably make a passing comment, a seemingly throwaway line about a massive failure, a bizarre client interaction, or a moment of deep doubt, and they will try to rush past it to get back to the safety of their framework.
It happens all the time.
A great interviewer utilizing dynamic follow-up catches that throwaway line, stops the expert, and says, wait, stop right there. Go back to what you just said about the client who fired you in 2018. What actually happened in that room?
Yes, and that is exactly when the expert drops their guard, the polished veneer cracks, and they give you the raw, vulnerable, deeply insightful story that they never would have thought to write down on an outline.
Exactly. Dynamic follow-up catches the threads, explores the contradictions, probes the gaps in logic, and pulls out the stories the expert didn't even realize were valuable.
If you just stick to a rigid script without dynamic follow-up, your book ends up reading like a sterile, defensive FAQ document. Layer 3 is what gives the book its heart and its humanity.
And this leads to the practical reality for the listener. What is the actual math on this? How much of the expert's time does this 3-layer question system require to generate a full manuscript?
I know you're bracing yourself, but it's much better than you think. The math of the dictate method is surprisingly manageable. To extract enough dense, high-quality material for a standard 200-page business book, you're generally looking at roughly 4 interview sessions per chapter, depending on chapter length.
Okay, 4 sessions a chapter.
Over the entire course of the project, that totals roughly 15 to 20 hours of the expert simply sitting in a chair and talking.
20 hours? Wait, really? Just 20?
Just 20 hours. And you don't do it all at once. You spread those 20 hours out over 4 to 6 weeks, a couple of hours a week. And if you choose to do a hybrid DIY route, where you hire a skilled human interviewer to conduct the 3-layer questions and pay for high-end transcription services to feed into an AI, your hard costs for capturing all of this raw material are usually well under $2,000.
That is just an unbelievable paradigm shift. You are trading 500 hours of agonizing, isolated typing, staring at a blinking cursor, battling imposter syndrome, and forcing yourself to manufacture motivation at 5 a.m. for 20 hours of engaging, dynamic conversation about a topic you already know inside and out.
It completely changes the game.
The system completely carries the psychological burden of creation. You just have to show up and answer the question.
It democratizes authorship for the busy professional. However, and we need to make this transition very clearly, because the book emphasizes this heavily, once you finish those 20 hours of talking, you are not finished with the book. The source is unequivocally clear. A raw transcript is not a manuscript.
Yes, we need to put that on a billboard. You have completed the interviews. You have a massive 300-page Word document filled with 20 hours of brilliant, dynamically extracted insights. You have secured the raw ore.
The ore, yes.
But if you just run that transcript through a basic spell checker, clean up the ums, ahs, and you knows, and slap a chapter title on it, it will be completely unreadable as a book.
It will be a disaster. Spoken explanation and written prose are related forms of communication, but they're entirely different mediums. Human conversation naturally wanders. It loops back on itself. It takes 5-minute detours to explain context. It repeats key phrases.
Whereas a book has to drive forward.
Exactly. A written chapter must move with relentless purpose and linear momentum. So how do we take that massive pile of raw transcript ore and refine it into gold? The dictate method outlines a rigid process called the 4 drafting passes.
Okay, I want to jump in immediately and warn the listener about the single most common fatal trap in this phase, because the book points this out, and I have seen it ruin so many projects.
Oh, the sentence level polish trap.
Yes. The biggest pitfall when an author first gets their raw transcript is attempting to do sentence level polish right out of the gate.
It is such a tempting trap.
It is. Authors get the transcript, they read the first paragraph, and they think, this sounds a bit clunky. So they spend 2 hours obsessing over paragraph 1, swapping out adjectives, agonizing over commas, trying to make it sound incredibly poetic and profound.
And then what happens?
Then a week later, they realize that paragraph 1 actually belongs in chapter 7, or worse, it doesn't fit the scorecard and needs to be deleted entirely. They just spent 2 hours polishing a paragraph that got cut.
It is a profound waste of emotional energy. The cardinal rule of the drafting phase is content before craft, structure before style. You never polish a sentence until the structure of the chapter is permanently locked. That is why the dictate method utilizes 4 distinct passes.
Let's walk through the sequence of these 4 passes.
Pass number 1 is the extraction pass. In this pass, you are not rewriting a single word. You are simply acting as a sorter. You look at the raw transcript for a chapter, and you sort the blocks of text into buckets.
What kind of buckets?
Well, here is a chunk of text that is clearly a story. Here's a chunk that explains the framework. Here's a chunk that offers statistical proof. And crucially, you identify the keeper phrases, those brilliant off-the-cuff signature one-liners that sound exactly like you. You pulled all these pieces out of the chronological transcript and put them in their respective buckets.
You are deconstructing the conversation into its component parts.
Exactly. Then you move to pass number 2, the assembly pass. Now that you have your buckets, you decide the logical linear sequence of the chapter.
Okay, so organizing the flow.
Right. A highly effective standard sequence for a business chapter might be, start by introducing the core problem to hook the reader. Then drop in a client story from your buckets to make the problem visceral and real. Next, reveal the contrarian insight. Then, teach the step-by-step framework to solve it. Finally, provide the practical application exercise. You simply take your buckets of raw text and snap them into that specific architectural sequence.
Okay, so now the chapter flows logically from A to B to C, but it still reads like a transcribed conversation.
Which brings us to pass number 3, the voice pass. This, and only this, is where the actual stylistic rewriting happens. This is where you, or the AI extraction system calibrated to your voice DNA, make the text read beautifully without losing your specific cadence.
It gets rid of the rambling.
You aggressively cut the rambling, circular explanations that were natural in conversation but slow down a printed page. You ensure your vocabulary fingerprint is present. The goal of the voice pass is to make the manuscript read exactly like the author, but on their absolute best, sharpest, most articulate day.
And then we reach pass number 4, which I think is the unsung hero of the entire method, the continuity pass. And this pass relies heavily on a specialized tool called the continuity ledger.
The ledger is absolutely vital.
I want you to explain this ledger, because I genuinely believe this is the safety net that prevents a multi-chapter book from structurally falling apart at the seams.
It absolutely is the safety net. A continuity ledger is conceptually very simple. It is a running spreadsheet or database that meticulously tracks concepts, promises, and stories across the entirety of the manuscript.
Why is that so necessary?
Because over a multi-week or multi-month drafting project, human memory inevitably, unequivocally fails. If you are deeply immersed in writing Chapter 8, it is incredibly difficult to remember exactly what level of detail you used to define a concept back in Chapter 3, which you worked on a month ago.
Right. You have these panic moments where you think, wait, did I already tell the story about the 70-hour work week? Did I already define what a capacity signal is, or do I need to explain it again here?
Exactly. Or worse, did I promise the reader a specific hiring framework in the introduction and then completely forget to actually include it in the middle of the book?
Ouch. That happens a lot.
The continuity ledger tracks all of these variables. It ensures you don't repeat the same anecdote twice. It ensures that if you introduce an acronym in Chapter 2, you consistently use it in Chapter 9. It guarantees that every promise made to the reader is fulfilled. It maintains the structural integrity of the book from page 1 to page 200.
That's brilliant.
Now, if you are using an advanced dictate AI system, the long context reasoning tracks this ledger automatically. If you are doing a manual extraction, you must rigidly update your spreadsheet after every single drafting session.
Okay, wow. So we have legally extracted the voice, we've structured the pillars, we've executed the 3-layer interviews, we've filled the scorecard, and we've refined the raw ore through the 4 drafting passes, checking the ledger along the way. The manuscript is finished, the book is written. Now, the source material briefly notes that there are about 15 logistical steps required to physically publish the book. Things like hiring a professional cover designer, setting up the Amazon KDP account, formatting the interior for print, securing ISBN numbers to identify the book globally. But we have successfully crossed the massive, intimidating hurdle of creation. However, the work doesn't just stop on launch day, does it?
It most certainly does not. In fact, Janalis makes a very passionate argument that the single biggest waste of potential in the entire professional publishing world is the author who throws a massive celebration on launch day, refreshes their Amazon ranking for a week, and then completely disappears by day 15.
Just crickets after 2 weeks?
The book quietly stops working for them, solely because the author stopped working the book.
Right. A book is a kinetic asset. It requires motion. So how do we ensure the book actually fulfills its destiny and unlocks those 5 revenue mechanisms we talked about at the very beginning? This brings us to the final section of our deep dive, the post-launch ecosystem, or what the book calls the 90-day plan.
The dictate method provides a highly tactical blueprint for the first 3 months after publication, broken down into 3 specific activation windows.
Okay, what's window 1?
The first window is days 1 through 14. Your immediate primary action during this 2-week window has nothing to do with social media algorithms or running Amazon ads. Your job is to physically mail signed hardcover copies of your book to your top 20 most valuable clients, past and present.
Not an email link, a physical book.
A physical, tangible object with a handwritten note. This action alone often provides the immediate ROI for the entire project. It triggers referrals because your clients now have a physical manifestation of your authority to hand to their peers. It triggers upsells because it reminds dormant clients of your expertise. And crucially, days 1 through 14 is the exact window where you fundamentally raise your consulting rates.
Right. Going back to the fee multiplier mechanism, you are no longer just the consultant they hired last year. You are now the published author of the definitive text on their specific problem. The market positioning has shifted, so the pricing must shift to reflect it.
Exactly. Then we enter the second window, days 15 through 45. This is the infrastructure phase. This is when you build a professional speaking one sheet centered entirely around the core concepts and the 7 pillars of your new book.
Oh, to start pitching yourself.
Right. You use this to start aggressively pitching industry podcasts, local conferences, and corporate workshops. This is also the window where you audit your own website. You take down that old, tired, poorly converting, 5-page PDF lead magnet, and you replace it with a high-value offer. Download the first chapter of my new published book for free.
Because a chapter of a real book holds infinitely more perceived value than a random PDF. And then we hit the final window, days 46 through 90, which is dedicated to the content engine.
The content engine.
Now, when I first read this section, I immediately had a reaction. I thought, how on earth is a busy expert who we already established doesn't have 500 hours to write a book supposed to suddenly maintain a massive daily social media presence to promote it while simultaneously running their business?
It sounds like another impossible demand on their time, doesn't it?
It really does. How did the dictate method resolve that friction?
Well, it provided a total aha moment. The resolution is that you do not have to invent new content. You don't have to wake up and stare at a blank LinkedIn post. The source breaks down the simple math of extraction.
Let's hear the math.
One standard business book usually contains about 12 chapters. During your drafting passes, you can easily extract 3 to 5 standalone, highly valuable ideas, stories, or frameworks from every single chapter. That equals roughly 40 to 60 standalone content ideas that are already perfectly written in your voice DNA.
The material already exists. You don't have to create anything.
Exactly. You just wrote 2 entire years' worth of consistent, high-quality LinkedIn posts, email newsletters, and scripts for short-form video content. You don't have to write anything new.
You just repurpose the gold you already mined.
You simply hand the finished manuscript to an executive assistant or a junior marketer and give them the directive. Pull 3 posts a week from this manuscript, format them for social media, and schedule them. You have built an automated content engine.
And that engine creates a powerful compounding effect, right?
A massive compounding effect. Every single LinkedIn post or newsletter you publish over the next 2 years constantly points back to the core framework in the book. That continuous exposure drives sustained book sales. The book sales drive inbound leads. The inbound leads buy your high-ticket services. The ecosystem feeds itself.
It's brilliant.
And that compounding effect brings us to the final and perhaps most ambitious piece of advice Janilis offers for this 90-day post-launch period.
Oh boy, what is it?
The moment you finish this 90-day sprint, you must immediately start a fresh notebook for book two.
Book two? We just spent this entire deep dive figuring out how to survive book one. That feels borderline sadistic.
I know it sounds overwhelming, but the strategic logic is unassailable. The first book is always the hardest because you are building the extraction infrastructure from scratch. But the second book, it is 10 times easier.
Because the machine is already built.
Exactly. You already have a captivated audience. You have the marketing infrastructure in place. You understand the 3-layer question system. And most importantly, your specific voice DNA is already perfectly mapped and ready to be deployed.
That makes a lot of sense.
The strategic reality of the publishing world is this. Writing one book makes you an author. Writing 2 books makes you a recognized category authority. Writing 3 books makes you the definitive, unassailable institutional voice in your space. The dictate method makes that level of prolific output realistically possible for someone who isn't a full-time writer.
That is an incredibly empowering vision of the future. Okay, let's zoom out and look at the massive landscape we've covered today because we have entirely deconstructed the traditional publishing model.
We really tore it down.
The central liberating message of this deep dive is that you do not need to fundamentally change who you are in order to write a powerful book. You do not need to suddenly become a disciplined, prose-obsessed writer waking up at 5 a.m. to bleed onto a keyboard. You simply need to do what you already do best. Start talking.
But you must talk into the right extraction systems.
Right. We covered mapping your voice DNA so it sounds authentic, establishing the 7 pillars to give it a spine, running the 3-layer question system with a scorecard to extract the ore, and refining that ore through the 4 drafting passes.
The dictate method permanently shifts the heavy burden of creation and structural organization from the exhausted human expert to the tireless system. And I want to leave you, the listener, with a final lingering thought that builds on everything we have discussed today.
Please do.
We have spent an hour talking primarily about what the authority gap costs you personally. The lost revenue, the missed speaking fees, the compromised market positioning. But I want you to shift your perspective for a moment. Think about the junior professionals, the rising managers, or the struggling clients in your specific industry right now.
Oh, wow. Yeah, the people coming up behind you.
They are out there right now, this very minute, actively making the exact same painful, expensive, emotionally draining mistakes that you figured out how to solve a decade ago.
That's so true.
Your refusal to extract the hard-won knowledge that is currently trapped inside your head isn't just costing you money and prestige. It is actively depriving others of the exact shortcut they are desperately searching for. When you allow your expertise to remain locked away simply because you are intimidated by the friction of a keyboard, you have to ask yourself, who else in my industry is paying the price for my silence?
That is a profoundly challenging, beautiful way to look at it.
Exactly.
It shifts the project from a business chore to an obligation to share what you know. We started this deep dive talking about a master surgeon who is completely paralyzed because someone handed them a typewriter instead of a scalpel. What we've comprehensively learned today is that you do not have to use the typewriter anymore. You can literally speak your mastery into existence, and the technological and structural tools are finally here to capture it perfectly. So, close that blank Google Doc, step away from the keyboard, grab a microphone, and go dictate your book into existence. Thank you so much for taking this deep dive with us. We will see you next time.